Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 27th of April. Rich Talcott is joining us this hour of the program to talk about this incredible find. I have so many questions. First of all, how do you find this new planet named 581c? It needs a better name than that. Let's call it something else during this hour. It was discovered by the European Southern Observatory's telescope in La Silla, is that how you pronounce it, in Chile? And it is the discovery of a new potentially habitable planet. It is 120 trillion miles away. It is a planet outside our solar system that has Earth-like temperatures, which is a huge step in the search for life in the universe. And it is, as one of the 11 European scientists on the team that found the planet said, it's a nice discovery. We still have a lot of questions, but it's a significant step on the way to finding possible life in the universe. They discovered a planet circling the red dwarf star, and we'll talk about that star. Red dwarfs are low-energy, tiny stars that give off dim red light and last longer than stars like our sun. The discovery of the new planet is sure to fuel studies of planets circling similar dim stars. About 80% of the stars near Earth are red dwarfs. So we're going to have a fun hour, you know, finding out how do you find this kind of thing? What does the telescope bring up? What are they looking for? How do they know they really had something here? We have as our guest this hour Rich Talcott, who has joined us before. Anytime there's news in the skies, somebody from Astronomy Magazine is with us. He joined the staff of Astronomy back in 1986. He edits The Sky This Month in the Center of Astronomy, as well as science and hobby features. He's written more than 100 feature articles for the magazine and produces most of the maps and diagrams that you see in Astronomy and Explore the Universe. He has authored Chasing the Shadow, an Observer's Guide to Eclipses, and he has witnessed 5 total solar eclipses and hopes to add many more to the total. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Rich. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hi, Rich. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
So how big a deal is this to find this?
It is a pretty big deal because astronomers have actually been finding planets for the last decade or so and now have more than 200 in their arsenal.
Wow.
But this is the first one that comes close to being somewhat like Earth. Hmm. And when I say somewhat like Earth, no one really knows exactly how close it might be to Earth. About the best thing we can say is that it's closer in size to Earth than any of the other planets that we've discovered so far.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say Earth-like, it conjures up visions of perhaps life and water and all those kinds of things, and we don't really have a clue what might be on the surface of this planet. So it's a little bit too much to say that it is Earth-like, but at least it's similar in size.
Yeah. Well, how did they know the temperature of this place? It sounds like the kind of temperatures that we have here on this Earth. How would you know this?
Well, it's actually pretty straightforward to do.
Really?
You mentioned earlier that the star that it goes around, which is called Gliese 581, is a cool red star. And so it doesn't put out anywhere near as much energy as the sun does. But the planet itself is much closer to its star than Earth is to the sun. It's about 14 times closer.
Hmm.
And you can do a fairly, I don't want to say simple calculation, but it's not terribly difficult either, to figure out how much energy the star gives off and then how far away the planet is from the star. And it turns out that everything else being equal, the temperature at the surface should be somewhere probably between about 32 degrees and maybe 100 degrees or so.
Mm-hmm. And how do you – tell me about this this telescope. I just can't fathom this, and I don't even understand what some of these words mean. But tell me about this telescope that was able to find this, how close they are, how close the images are. And then they have a special instrument, and I don't know what this means, Rich, so help me out, a special instrument that splits light to find wobbles in different wavelengths, and those wobbles can reveal the existence of other worlds.
Right. And a lot of people think that what you need to do to find planets around other stars is to take really sharp images of the star and then look for little pinpoints of light near it. But that's not really the way it works most of the time. And the reason for that is that stars are so much brighter than the planets because planets don't give off light on their own. They just reflect sunlight. If you were to be as far away from our solar system as this one is to ours and look back at it, trying to see Earth would be kind of like trying to see a firefly next to a big searchlight of a lighthouse or something like that. It would be extremely difficult to be able to see it just because of the light. So what astronomers do is they break up the light that comes from the star into its various wavelengths using what's called a spectrograph. And what that does is it also not only tells us what the star is made out of, but it also tells us how fast the star is moving towards and away from us because the lines in the spectrum shift either towards or away from us depending on whether the star is coming towards or away from us. So if you happen to have a planet moving around the star, its gravity is going to affect that star slightly and cause it to move either slowly towards us or slowly away from us as the planet orbits. And they can pick up these changes in the spectrum based on how much that star is moving. And from that determine how big the star is and how long it or how big the planet is and how long it takes to move around the star.
Tell me what it means for this to be 120 trillion miles away. For us to get there, it couldn't happen in this lifetime.
No, certainly not in our lifetime. We actually have a few spacecraft. The Voyager spacecraft are the best example that are currently well beyond the orbit of Pluto and heading out into interstellar space. But they're still on the order of billions of miles away from us, not anywhere near a trillion miles. And they've been at it for 30 or 40 years now. So at the rate that they're traveling to reach the nearest stars, such as this one, would take on the order of millions of years. And so it's certainly not something we're going to be doing in our lifetime.
I guess not. Don't you find it amazing that we have a telescope that allows us to learn all of this about a planet that's 120 trillion miles away?
That is pretty impressive. But it turns out that telescopes have gotten pretty good, particularly over the last dozen years or so that they've been finding these planets. And the motions that some of these planets can make in their stars is certainly enough that you can detect the fine motion that the star is under.
It has an atmosphere, but we're not sure what the atmosphere is.
That's one of those questions that we don't really know very much about and why it's a little tricky to start calling these things Earth-like is because we don't know if it has an atmosphere or not. The method that they use to find this planet, and I might mention that the vast majority of the planets that have been discovered so far were found using the same method. It doesn't tell us anything about the planet itself beyond how big it is and how long it takes to orbit around the star.
Interesting.
So it may have a atmosphere, and it may not. It could have a very thick atmosphere and be something more along the lines of our planets Uranus and Neptune, which basically may have a small rocky core but are mostly gaseous. So we don't really know if it's has a rocky surface, if it's mostly gas, if it's similar to Earth in that it has a rocky surface with a fairly thin atmosphere around it or anything like that.
Yeah. So how do we learn about that, Rich?
That's something that we probably can't learn about very easily. The reason being that, as I mentioned, trying to see one of these planets around a star is extremely difficult because the star doesn't, or the planet doesn't give off very much light relative to the star. And so trying to pinpoint this planet with a telescope and actually take its spectrum and learn about it is going to be fairly difficult. I should mention, though, that within the next decade to 15 years, NASA has plans to launch a spacecraft or two that might be able to actually pinpoint these types of planets around stars. And if they do that, they can take spectra of the planet themselves and learn what those planets may be made of.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there may be hope another 10, 15 years down the road that we may be able to get enough information to learn what the conditions are like on this planet.
Now, one of the press reports that I was reading said that eventually astronomers will rack up discoveries of dozens, maybe even hundreds of planets considered habitable. Would you agree with that?
I think it's certainly reasonable to say so. since they started discovering the first planets about a dozen years ago, we've, as I mentioned earlier, we've already come up with more than 200 planets. Now, most of these are fairly big planets, and the reason for that probably makes sense if you think about it, because the method they use is to see how much the planet causes the star to move back and forth. And so a bigger planet is going to cause the star to move faster, and it's a much easier detection to make. So as time goes on, we're going to be able to get finer and finer results and find smaller and smaller planets. And as we do so, we'll probably get things that are much closer to Earth size.
Mm-hmm.
This planet itself is about five times the size of Earth in terms of how much matter it contains. So it's still on the large size relative to Earth. And its diameter is about 50% bigger than Earth's is. So it's what's called a super-Earth in the sense that it's much bigger than Earth, but it's closer to the size of Earth than any of the ones we've found so far.
And you'd be a super-sized person if you lived there, right? We'd be a lot heavier? For what reason?
Yeah, we'd be a lot heavier for the same reason that if we happened to go to a larger planet in our solar system, there's more matter to pull us, to have gravity pull us down to the surface, and that's what causes our weight. So the bigger mass of this planet would cause us to weigh more.
Yeah. Oh, don't you wish if there were people there, they'd come over and say hi? I really thought that would happen in my lifetime. I really did.
I guess I'm on the skeptical side of that one. For the same reason that we'd have a hard time going to this star.
I know.
And anybody on this planet would have a difficult time reaching us. Although if you went back 1,000 years in our history and even talked about sending a spacecraft to another planet in our solar system, you'd probably be laughed at. So
yeah.
Who knows what might happen thousands of years from now, and
right.
If there were any living beings on this planet, how much longer they may have been around than we have been. So
yeah.
It's certainly not out of the realm of fantasy, but it's probably very unlikely.
Yeah. Now tell me about what's happening outside the solar system with 581C. Is it because the universe is expanding? Is it moving farther away from us?
Actually, no. And the universe is expanding, but that only really shows up if you start looking at galaxies beyond our own.
Oh.
In our own Milky Way galaxy, the stars pretty much orbit around the center of our galaxy and change position over many thousands, millions of years, that kind of thing, but very slowly. And so we wouldn't notice the change in distance to this star over our many lifetimes.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a lot of people who'd like to, to speak with you. Our guest is Rich Talcott, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, and we're talking about this remarkable discovery of a planet that is outside our solar system that has been described as potentially habitable. It's 120 trillion miles away. It was discovered by 11 European scientists, the team that found the planet, and they found it by the European Southern Observatory's telescope in Chile. A guy who works at the Carnegie Institute of Washington, where a team of U.S. astronomers had competed in the hunt for an Earth-like planet, called it a major milestone in this business. It meets a lot of the qualifications for having life, and most of that has to do with temperature, that the temperature is right, based on theory, it should have an atmosphere, although they don't know yet what is in that atmosphere. But the average temperature should be somewhere between 32 and 104 degrees. And until now, all of the 220 planets that astronomers have found outside our solar system have had what's been called the Goldilocks problem. They've either been too hot, too cold, or just plain too big and gaseous. All right, phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. Rich Talcott is our guest, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. He's been there since 1986, and he brings a lifelong interest in the science of astronomy as well as observing the night sky. He edits The Sky This Month in the Center of Astronomy, as well as many science and hobby features. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We get a phone calls now for Rich, starting with Ron from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Thanks very much. I'm concerned about how they can calculate the mass of a planet. I know we could calculate the minimal mass. I'll try to explain this. Teaching plane geometry over the phone and radio is going to be challenging for all of us. Okay. This planet is orbiting a star 20-some light years away. The angle that the plane of that planet's orbit through the center of its star makes with the plane that connects that star to the Earth, if that was exactly zero, then we can calculate what the mass of that planet would be. And that's, I think, the only mass we can really calculate. Because if that angle was 30 degrees or 60 degrees or 80 degrees, then it would be a much larger planet. If we say that planet is twice the mass of the Earth, if it's in the same plane as the Earth to that star, then if that plane actually is like 80 degrees different, that planet might weigh 100 or 1,000 times as much as our Earth. I hope you comprehend what I'm trying to say. But how do you determine that angle? And unless you, is there some way without determining that angle between these two planes that you can come up with the actual mass of the planet, not the minimal mass, if it's all in a straight line? Thank you.
That's an excellent question, and you're exactly right. We only know what its minimum mass is because when we take a look at these stars out there, we don't know what kind of orbit the planet has around it. And if it's tilted somewhat to ours, you might imagine, doing a little thought experiment, that if the planet was orbiting face on to us, all the gravitational pull on the star would be up and down relative to our line of sight and not toward or away from us. And you can have any angle between that and edge on to our line of sight. It turns out that there's good reason to think that any objects that we find around other stars are more likely to be closer to edge on than they are to face on, for the very simple reason that the closer they are to face on, the much harder they are to find. So I would say that the five Earth masses that we're talking about for this planet is certainly something that's a minimum mass, but most likely it's not going to be, say, 100 or 1,000 times Earth's mass, because that would be getting into a situation where it would be typically very difficult to find these kinds of objects.
Hmm.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks for the call. Buck is next from Madison. Hi, Buck.
How good of you to talk about stars. And Edmund Scientific sells accessibly priced telescopes for us to look through. And the Abrams Planetarium in the University of Michigan in East Lansing will send you stuff for $14 a year saying what the sky is going to look like. But my question is, going sideways, do you have any opinions about the possibility of our sun being in a binary system and thus explaining the Hindu yugas of good ages and bad ages, where we are not only going around the Milky Way, but are also doing a loop-de-loop as we go? So what's your opinion about us in a binary system?
My opinion would be that it's very unlikely. It's certainly not a zero chance, because scientists have taken a look at this and said it could be that we're in an orbit that goes out around another star that goes out very far, and it just happens to be faint enough and in such a direction that we haven't been able to spot it yet. But it would have to be a very faint star to have passed without us being able to see it. And there are other things about it, too. If we're talking about on the time scale of human history, and you mentioned the Hindus and the possibility of their having seen things, over the course of several thousand or 10,000 of years, we probably would have been able to, if we were able to see it even 10,000 years ago, the odds are we'd still be able to see it now. If we're talking about being in an actual system, probably the changes would take place over much longer time periods, probably on the hundreds of thousands or not millions of years. And so if we're talking about things that have been seen during human history, I would say that it's probably not something that has to do with us being in a binary system.
Anything else, Buck?
The period proposed is 24,000 years. The opposite being is not known, but it might be one of those pesky brown dwarfs, you know?
Yeah, brown dwarf, just for listeners that aren't familiar, are objects that are not quite large enough to be stars, but they maybe have something like 5% or 1% the mass of the sun. Mm. And those objects would not give off much light, and so they could kind of be hiding out there and not in a position where we'd be able to see it necessarily. I would still say, though, if we're talking on the order of tens of thousands of years, it's probably unlikely that that people had observed things even 4,000 years ago that we would not be able to still detect now, because the orbit of this kind of object would be probably much longer than that.
Hmm. Buck, is this your avocation or vocation?
It is. I am a third-level polymath, so I have many avocations, but this is one.
All right. And it's a good one. Thanks, Buck.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Our number 800-486-8655, and we have lines open. Lucia is next from Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, I was noting that it was discovered by some people in Chile, and then they said European.
The telescope was in Chile. It's European scientists.
Okay. Were there any Americans on this team? And if not, do Americans collaborate with other countries to discover things?
They were having a competition, weren't they? It's my understanding, Rich.
It's a friendly competition. Uh-huh. Yeah. There are actually two major teams that are out there that are actually looking for planets using what's called the radial velocity method, which is to detect the motion of these stars caused by planets. And it turns out that the Europeans were the first ones to discover planets about a dozen years ago, but the American team has actually discovered more planets currently, and there are over 100 planets having been discovered by the Americans.
Hmm.
It turns out that right now the teams are work by themselves, so the European team that observed down in Chile are working separately from the American team, who usually are out in California or in Hawaii using those telescopes. In some ways, the Europeans are looking more toward the southern sky, because from Chile you get to see a better view of the southern sky than we do up here.
Right.
And the American teams have been concentrating more on what's visible in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah. And can you tell me more about this radial velocity method? What is that?
Yeah, that's the one that I was talking about. The radial velocity is simply the motion along the line of sight.
Oh.
And so when we're taking a look at these stars, what we're trying to do is figure out how fast they're moving toward us and away from us in response to the planet orbiting around the star.
I see. Thanks very much for the call. And we go next to Prince from Fish Creek. Hi, Prince.
Good morning.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, Prince. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Thank you. Yeah, I was thinking of Carl Sagan and the Cosmos series, and what a fine production that was. And then thinking, well, if you come to naming it, you ought to name it Trafalmador.
That would probably be a good name. Right now, it has a very uninteresting name. It's named after its star and with a letter after it to denote the order of the planets found around that star. So right now, it has the very uninteresting name of Gliese 581c, which is not going to roll off anyone's tongue, obviously.
No.
Probably for quite a while, we're going to keep doing this kind of thing where we name it after the star and then give it a letter designation afterwards. And part of that is because we keep finding more planets around stars. And so to give this one a certain name and then perhaps find another one in the same system that perhaps is even a little bit more like Earth might be going a little bit too far. And so at this stage, I think it's easier to do the letter designations. I might mention that astronomers have already found two other planets around this star. One of them has about 15 times Earth's mass, and it is in a 5-day orbit around the star. And then there's one with 8 times Earth's mass that's in an 84-day orbit around the star.
Hmm.
And so we know at least three planets around this star currently, and it's quite possible we'll find more and smaller ones over the course of time.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a very vast space out there.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Prince, for the call. It is, isn't it? All you have to do is say that word vast, and it just throws you into another realm of existence, doesn't it? It is, It's vast.
That's for sure. Yeah, talking about trillions of miles and so many light years, it's easy to throw the numbers around, but it's kind of hard to wrap your mind about how far it is.
Yeah. Thanks, Prince, so much for the call. We go to Scott next. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi there. I don't want to turn your program into the X-Files here, Kathleen, but I did want to follow up on what Buck had mentioned about a possible companion star. And there's actually a book that was out called, I forget what it was, Nine Crazy Ideas in Science, some of which might actually be true. And there was a chapter on this, and they refer to it as the Nemesis Star. And what they say about it is that if it's for real, that it would appear periodically and could possibly explain the gravitational force that turns loose the comets out of the Oort cloud that have rained down and smashed into the Earth, causing a lot of the mass extinctions that have periodically happened. There seems to be sort of a pattern of every so many million years, life on Earth takes some severe hits. And one way to explain that would be if the Nemesis star, say a brown dwarf, got close enough over those millions of years, and it's not 24,000, but it would be millions, that it would have a gravitational force. It would pull things out of the Oort cloud. That would then head in. A lot of it would be sucked up by the gas giants, but what didn't could possibly get through, smash into Earth, and cause extinctions. And I'm sure your person there is much more of an expert. He's going to correct everything I just said. But I didn't want to say it.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, Scott. Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, that's actually where the serious idea of perhaps the sun being in a binary system developed from is the fact that there was a noticed periodic rate at which large numbers of species on Earth went extinct. The biggest example everyone knows about is the one that happened 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs disappeared. But there have been other ones over that have been measured reasonably accurately over several hundred million years. And there does seem to be a period that is on the order of tens of millions of years, perhaps. And the thought was perhaps this could be a brown dwarf or a very low-mass star that's in orbit around the sun. And what happens is that it passes through our cloud of comets that exist a long ways away from us and sends a rain of them down toward Earth. And if we happen to get hit by enough or a big enough one, as seemed to have happened when the dinosaurs went, then they could cause these extinctions. That's certainly the idea behind the possibility that we may be in a binary system. And as I mentioned, and the caller did too, this was on the order of millions or tens of millions of years in terms of its orbit and not on the order of thousands or tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not something that scientists have dismissed. There is the thought out there that something like that could happen, but nobody has any evidence beyond these mass extinctions. There hasn't been any discovery of an object like this. There hasn't been any real notice of changes in the sun's motion that might be attributed to this. And so I don't think most scientists would say the odds are very good that it could happen, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility.
Yes. Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. Michael is next. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Kathleen. And a very interesting subject. I'm glad we're talking about it. I sent the email to my grandson, and we're having a dialogue going on. He's only five.
Oh, good for you. Great. Yeah.
But I would like to have the guests speak to the issue of it. It would seem to me that now that we've kind of discovered this, that we would be sending at least some sort of exploratory spacecraft at this object, as well as the SETI project being beamed straight towards it so that it would send its radio waves and whatever it's doing to make contact. What does he think about that?
Let me first just say that the SETI project, SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and they actually have looked at this star a few times over the last, I think, about 20 years or so. They've looked at it two or three times in that period and haven't detected any radio communications or any radio waves coming from this area. Doesn't necessarily mean that means there isn't life or anything like that, but they
just
have
don't have
looked
radios
at it a couple of times.
Yeah.
As looking for radio waves. The question of sending a spacecraft to it is always an interesting one. And I mentioned before that the rate at which our current rockets can go, it would take literally millions of years to get there. And I don't think, at the moment anyway, we can build a spacecraft that would last millions of years through interstellar space to make it there. But it does raise an interesting question. At what point do you decide it is worth sending a spacecraft in a certain direction because you think there may be something there that's worth looking at least outside of our solar system? And it becomes kind of interesting because you can think about sending one now and having it take millions of years. If we wait 100 years, the technology would probably be such that it could get there in 100,000 years. So why not just wait another 100 years to send it? But then the theory goes, well, if you wait another 100 years after that, it may only take 5,000 years to get there. And you can keep on making this argument that we should never send a spacecraft there because another 100 years down the road, we're going to be able to do it better. And so I don't think that's necessarily a reason for us not to send a spacecraft in that direction. What I would argue at this stage is that we keep finding more and more planets using these various search techniques. And over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to discover many, many more planets, probably many of which are much more similar to Earth than even this one is. And I would say, before we get to the stage of deciding to send a spacecraft in toward this planet specifically, we should see what the landscape looks like in another couple of decades and then decide which one may be the most likely to have the potential for life.
Terrific. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. How close would you have to get? Could you send a spaceship now that, you know, obviously we can't wait millions of years to get an answer here. I mean, somebody will get an answer, but we won't know what's going on. Could you send something now that would get close enough to answer some of those questions about atmosphere, about water, about life, or not?
I don't think we could send a spacecraft with our current technology that would get there. That would get close enough to do anything for probably close to those same many millions of years. You might think of the sophisticated spacecraft we have now that move throughout our solar system, but they don't really get good views of the planets that they're getting close to until they're really pretty close to where they're heading.
I see.
And so we'd probably have to wait a long time. Probably we're better off waiting for a few space-based telescopes in that may come along in the next dozen years or so that may be able to actually take a much closer look at planets around stars. The basic technique that they're planning on using is what's called in a coronagraph, and basically all that means is that they're going to block out the light from the star, much in the same way as you can hold your fist over the sun if the sun ever comes out again, and you can block that and see things that are closer to the star because you're blocking out the light from the star itself. They're probably within a dozen years or so, the technology will be such that we can send these things up into Earth orbit and be able to block the light from the star and actually get a fairly decent look at any planets that might be around relatively nearby stars anyway, and get at least some feel for what may be making up these planets.
Yeah. Did you have anything else, Michael? Michael's gone. Thanks so much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. The senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, which is assembled and published right here in Milwaukee, is with us to talk about this planet that was found fairly recently. It was discovered by the European Southern Observatory's telescope in Chile. They have a special instrument that splits light to find wobbles in different wavelengths, and the wobbles can reveal the existence of other worlds. What they revealed is this new planet, 581c, and it's quite a find, evidently. There's a lot that's still not known, but it looks as though the average temperature is somewhere between 32 and 104 degrees. It looks as though 581c could have an atmosphere, but what's in the atmosphere is a mystery. It would take millions of years to get there, but I think it's amazing that it was found by this phenomenally sensitive telescope. And we're talking with Rich Talkett, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, about what the significance of this find. So you want to join us? One line open, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Just briefly a reminder that our spring pledge drive will start on May 3rd, so your online pledge before the drive would help shorten the drive. If you'd like to pledge right now, that'd be great. Members have already contributed over $10,000 toward our goal of $275,000. And when we reach the goal, the drive will end. If we reach it before the 3rd of May, we won't even start the drive. Pledge online, WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now, 800-486-8655. We go to Pat from Marinette. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a very basic question that has bothered me for a while. I seem to have lost the Milky Way.
Oh, my. That's a bad loss.
Yeah. When I grew up in northern Illinois, I can remember often being out at night and seeing the Milky Way so pretty in the sky. And now, maybe some 60 years later, I live about 300 miles north of there, and I never see the Milky Way. Is it certain seasons, or just why can't I see it?
Well, the problem is probably what we astronomers like to call light pollution, and it's simply that over the last several decades, and certainly over 60 years, there's a lot more lighting on the ground than there used to be, and what happens is that this light gets reflected back up into the sky, and it makes it harder to see fainter things. And the Milky Way is reasonably faint from most areas. Now, 60 years ago, there weren't anywhere near as many lights down here on the surface, and so we could see these faint things like the Milky Way. I will comment, as you mentioned, there are certain seasons of the year when the Milky Way is more visible, and right now is not one of the best ones. Usually in the summertime, say June, July, August is an excellent time to go out and see the Milky Way. But you really need to get pretty far away from the lights of the city or even the lights of towns and out into a dark country sky. And then it'll still be there. I've seen it fairly recently, so it hasn't disappeared for sure.
Well, that's comforting to me. At least I know it's still there.
And yes.
That, no doubt, is the reason, although I don't live in an especially lighted area.
No, you don't.
But when I was a kid, I lived on a farm. So, okay, thank you very much.
All right, happy viewing this summer. I mean, that would be quite a discovery for her again, to have been missing the Milky Way all this time and to be able to see it again. It is one of those things in life. If you've done that as a child or growing up, and it's a sense of wonder. It's a sight to behold. It's something you want to see again and again.
Sure, and it's one of those things that we live out here in Waukesha, and it's certainly reasonably close to Milwaukee and a decent-sized city itself, but you can see reasonably faint stars in the sky, but it's not anywhere near dark enough to be able to see the Milky Way. So you really kind of have to head out into the deep, dark woods of northern Wisconsin, perhaps, to be able to see it reliably, at least, or to be able to see it well enough that you can say, yeah, that's it, I've seen it.
Thanks so much for the call, Pat. We go to Chris next from Two Rivers. Hi, Chris. Hi, Chris.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you.
You need to talk. Chris, you got to call us back. I'm sorry, if you got to call in, you got to talk. Bruce from Canada. Hi. Hi, Bruce. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
Well, my name is Bruce Heyer. I'm from Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. I drive it in my car. My cell phone. And I'm finding this whole thing fascinating and amusing and a little depressing. The question for me is not whether there might be intelligent life on other planets billions of years away. The question for me is whether there is intelligent life on Earth. And before we start worrying about life on Earth, it would be really nice if we ensured that life continued on this planet, to be talking about maybe sending space probes out in hundreds of years. When we're not sure if life is going to survive on this planet due to our own activities, seems to me to be highly ironic.
Want to respond to that, Rich?
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't argue with your statement. I think it is kind of interesting. Lots of people talk about whether there's intelligent life on Earth, and I think at some level anyway, the fact that we're able to find planets around other stars is a good sign that we have some sort of intelligence anyway. And I guess perhaps I'm optimistic, but I think we'll figure out ways to get around our problems and make sure that intelligence survives at least as long as Earth is in pretty much the same situation it is now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Bob is next. Hi, Bob.
Yeah. Hey, great show, and congratulations on your discovery here. It's just fascinating.
kind of stuff I wish I would have had a chance to do if I were smarter. Okay, here's the question I've got for you, and it's the star Sirius A, the brightest star that we can see. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Sure.
Okay, it's a giant. It's like 20 times solar mass. And these things, when they go extinct, I don't think they go to the red giant phase. I believe they just go to supernova. What is the sterilization radius around those things when they go off?
Well, the good news is that you're at least a little bit misinformed in that Sirius is not quite 20 times the mass of the sun. It's more like two to three times the mass of the sun. And so it's not big enough to actually explode when it reaches the end of its life. Now, that being said, there are certainly stars out there that are big enough, and to be big enough, they usually have to be bigger than about 10 times the sun's mass for them to explode at the end of their lives. And presumably there are approximately one or two such supernovae going off every 100 years or so in our galaxy. It turns out that you have to be reasonably close to such a supernova to be, as you said, sterilized, probably within, say, a dozen or so light years of where the star is. So you're going to have to be pretty close. There are certainly no stars like that that are that close to us right now. Now, that being said, it doesn't mean that it wouldn't put on a spectacular show. You may recall having heard about the supernova that went off in the year 1054, actually on July 4th in 1054, and it was bright enough that it could be seen in daylight for a few months' period of time. So these things, even if they're a couple of thousand light years away, are bright enough that they put on a tremendous show in the sky, but that they probably have to be closer than it seems that any major star that might go supernova in the near future would.
And thanks very much for your call. We have lines open right now. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 for those of you who are joining us in Milwaukee. Our guest is the senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, and we're talking about the discovery of this new planet far, far away, but it may be habitable. It seems to have the conditions. It was discovered by the European Southern Observatory's telescope in Chile. It has a special instrument on it that finds wobbles. And one of the 11 European scientists on the team said it's a nice discovery. We still have a lot of questions. So we're talking about that with Rich. And, you know, he's also the guy who writes The Sky in the Month, The Sky This Month in the Center of Astronomy. He writes a lot of science and hobby features for the magazine. So those of you who are familiar with this lovely magazine published right here are familiar with some of his writings. Tell me, before we go back to phone calls, a little bit more about the solar eclipses that you've witnessed. Five of them, Rich?
Yeah. That they're always a lot of fun.
I'll bet.
The first one I saw was back in 1991, and it was down in the Baja Peninsula of Mexico. And the most recent one I saw was just last year over in Turkey, last spring. And I'm hopeful, although I don't have specific plans yet, that I'll be able to go to one that's going to be occurring over in Siberia in 2008.
Oh, my gosh.
Or over in China in 2009. So there are a couple more coming up. I have to admit that seeing a total solar eclipse is something that you don't soon forget.
Really?
And a lot of people have seen partial solar eclipses where maybe 80, 90% of the sun is gone from the sky and think, well, a total eclipse is maybe just 10% better than that. But it's so different that even seeing a 99% partial eclipse doesn't give you any idea what it's like to see the total eclipse, where the sun basically disappears from the sky, and what you see is its outer atmosphere that's invisible all the other times come into view. It's really a...
And what does that look like? What does the outer atmosphere look like?
It usually has a bunch of streamers that stretch out often two or three times what the sun's normal diameter would be. So you see this kind of gauzy white light appearing all around the sun, and it really seems to shimmer almost. It doesn't necessarily change shape rapidly, but it appears to shimmer in the sky.
Oh, my. So how many do you want to see in your lifetime?
Oh, I'll keep going as long as they keep happening, which will be well after I'm gone. So.
Yeah. Joe from Green Bay is next. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you guys?
Fine. How are you, Joe?
Great show. I have a question. We have the Voyager spacecrafts that are still out there, as far as we know. Do they still track them, and are they still going out to different galaxies and sending back signals?
Yeah, the Voyager spacecraft are actually the ones that I talked about earlier that have already left or at least have gone beyond the orbit of Pluto and are heading out toward interstellar space. And the NASA is still in contact with them, and occasionally they don't spend a lot of time because they aren't necessarily near anything out there that they can necessarily get exciting information back to us about. But they do check in from time to time just to make sure that they're still operating, and they still are. They're quite far away now. And what the astronomers are hoping is that they'll survive at least as long so that they can pass through what's called the heliopause, which is just a fancy name for the edge of the sun's influence in space. And at that point, it would actually be considered to be an interstellar space. So it's kind of, scientists are hoping that it will get to the stage and still be functioning at that time.
Thanks, Joe, so much for your call. We go to Mary next from Madison. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Hey, yes, I was wondering if he could tell us the difference between a brown dwarf and a red dwarf.
Sure, no problem. Scientists have came up with these names actually quite a while ago before they knew necessarily about the differences between stars, and the distinctions have gotten kind of blurred a little bit over the course of the years. But basically, a red dwarf is a star in much the same way that the sun is, and actually scientists would call the sun a dwarf star as well. It just means that it hasn't swelled up to a giant stage yet. But a red dwarf is simply a cool star. Usually it has somewhere on the order of about a tenth the mass of the sun, and so it burns its hydrogen fuel very slowly. And these stars, and LISA 581, the one that has the planet around it we've been talking about, is a good example of this kind of star. It will last for literally trillions of years on the way that it burns its fuel so slowly. The sun, on the other hand, will burn through its fuel in about 10 billion years, so it's a much quicker lifetime for our sun. Now, brown dwarfs are simply called that because they aren't big enough to actually go through the fusion process that gives stars their energy. Red dwarfs are stars, and they generate their own energy. Brown dwarfs are just a little bit smaller, less than about 8% the sun's mass, and they cannot generate their own energy on the inside. And so basically they're just cooling off, and they're glowing dimly in the sky. So we actually know of a few dozen of these things, but scientists tell us that there should be many, many more of these brown dwarfs probably than there are red dwarfs. It's simply that they don't give off much energy, and so we don't see very many of them.
Anything else, Mary?
Yes. No, he said that that planet he's talking about and the Earth are red dwarfs.
The planets themselves are probably, or the planet we're talking about is probably either a rocky object or something with a fairly large atmosphere around it. The star that this new planet is going around is a red dwarf star, and it has about a third the sun's size. Our sun is a normal dwarf star, what would be called a yellow dwarf because it glows yellow, and it's simply hotter than these red dwarf stars are, so it has a yellow appearance instead of a red one.
Hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Anything to be looking forward to in the May sky, Rich?
Probably the most interesting thing that's going to be going on is that Venus is going to be very high and bright in the late evening sky. Venus is usually one of those objects that you tend to think of as either a morning or an evening star and mm-hmm. kind of immersed in bright twilight. But it's at the peak of its eight-year let me rephrase that. It goes through a cycle over about 8 years where it becomes quite high in the sky after it gets dark, and it's right in that time right now. So if you head outside after the sun goes down, you can see Venus really high in the west, and it will stay up until pretty close to midnight, actually.
Oh, and my.
It's the brightest object in the sky, not counting the sun and the moon, so it really stands out.
Mm-hmm. How often do you go out? Well, we haven't been able to see anything in the last – it's been raining – but how often do you go out and look at the sky when you can see the sky? Do you do this every day?
I usually go out every night that it's clear. I don't necessarily pull my telescope out every night. If there's something special going on that I want to see close up, I'll get the telescopes or binoculars out. But I'm usually out at least for a little while every clear night to take a look at what the sky is doing.
Yeah. I can see your fascination with this whole field. It grabs you, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Thanks, Rich.
You're welcome.
Rich Talcott, our guest, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. He has been studying the skies for all of his life. He has been a lecturer in physics department at Ohio State University. And he joined the staff at Astronomy in early 1986. He edits the Sky This Month in the Center of Astronomy, as well as science and hobby features. And he has written more than 100 feature articles for the magazine, producing most of the maps and the diagrams that you see in Astronomy and also in Explore the Universe. He's the author of Chasing the Shadow, An Observer's Guide to Eclipses, and he has witnessed 5 total eclipses and hopes to add many more to the list of eclipses that he has seen. So that was interesting, huh? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, to Rita Thomas for our on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks everybody for all of your calls. If you would like, you could get a copy of this hour by calling the radio store. The phone number is 800-747-7444, and the program number of this show is 427E, and this show repeats at 10 o'clock tonight. Have a lovely weekend. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.